So my timing, Ozan, could not have been more perfect. I invested right at the beginning of the tech boom and cashed out right before the bubble burst in 2000.
Welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. Today's guest on the show is Ryan Levesque. Ryan is the CEO of the Ask Method Company and the number one national best-selling author of Ask, the counterintuitive online method to discover exactly what your customers want to buy, which was named by Inc. as the number one marketing book of the year. Ryan's work has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Forbes, and Entrepreneur, among many other media outlets, and over 250,000 entrepreneurs subscribe to his email newsletter offering business advice. His latest book is called Choose. Choose helps readers avoid making the single biggest mistake when starting a business and guides people through answering that all-important question, which is, what type of business should you start? You can get a free copy of Choose. Yes, that's free. You just have to pay shipping and handling, plus over $200 in bonuses, including the audiobook, by visiting choosethebook.com/famous failures. Once again, that's choosethebook.com/famous failures. This is not an affiliate link, as is true for the other offers made by the guests featured on the show. If you choose to buy Ryan's book, I don't make a dime from that. In the interview, Ryan and I discuss how Ryan quit his dream job at AIG Insurance to pursue a career as an entrepreneur, why people are afraid to give up good to go for great, and what to do about it. The one advice that Ryan would give to an aspiring entrepreneur, why one of Ryan's earliest businesses flopped and what he learned from that failure, how Ryan found the idea for a massively successful business centered, of all things, on growing orchids, and why Ryan ended up in the ICU, the intensive care unit in the hospital in 2012 after overworking, and how he bounced back to write a best-selling book. Before I play you the interview, if you've been enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to a friend. That goes a long way in spreading the word. And if you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian, which goes out every Thursday morning. And it offers an article, a new article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations for books I enjoyed and other tools I would recommend, other articles I would recommend, really anything that helps you challenge conventional wisdom and helps you look at the world in a different way. You can sign up for that by heading over to weeklycontrarian.com. That's weeklycontrarian.com, and just dropping in your email address. If you sign up, you'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, please enjoy my interview with Ryan Levesque, and thank you, as always, for listening. Ryan, welcome to the show.
It is so awesome to be here. I'm looking forward to chatting.
So I have been debating about where to start this interview, and I'm going to start in perhaps an unlikely place, but I think it's going to make for an interesting story. So let's begin there. You went to Brown, and one of the things that struck me is that you paid for much of your own college education without financial assistance and without taking out any loans, and you graduated debt free. Can you tell us how you did that? And I'm asking that question because college tuition is skyrocketing, but even when you went to college, it still was high, yet you were able to manage paying for it, much of it, on your own. How did you do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I grew up blue collar. Neither of my parents went to college. I was the first in my family to apply to college, get accepted to college, and go to college. My dad worked as a shipping clerk, basically loading boxes on the back of trucks. He worked nights. And my mom cut hair in the basement of our house to earn a little bit of extra income. So neither of them had a professional background or even a college education. But one thing that they taught me was the importance of investing at a very young age. And they didn't know what that meant, but they just knew the importance of investing in yourself, investing in your future, investing in your education. And so when my grandparents passed away, they passed away when I was 10 years old, and they left my sister and I with an inheritance. And it was everything that they had, and it was $5,000 each. And my mom said, you can do whatever you want with this $5,000. Grandma and Grandpa gave it to you. Now, for whatever reason, as a 10, soon to be 11-year-old, I was fascinated with investing in the stock market. And I remember 11 years old reading every Peter Lynch book that I could get my hands on, One Up on Wall Street, and you know every book I could get my hands on, ordering the S&P books, which at the time were physical books that looked like phone books that had the annual reports of every company in the Standard & Poor's, and just becoming obsessed with this. And so I took the $5,000 and I invested it in the stock market. When I turned 18, so about 8 years later, I translated that $5,000 into a little over $80,000. Now, I would love to say that it was like just pure precocious brilliance that led to that investment return. But when I was 10 years old to 18 years old, it just happened to coincide with the greatest bull run in the market's history, which led up to the 2000.com bubble. So my timing, Ozan, could not have been more perfect. I invested right at the beginning of the tech boom and cashed out right before the bubble burst in 2000 and used that money to pay for most of my college education. So with a little bit of hard work and a lot of luck, that's the secret. But I'll say that, you know, it taught me a lot because I grew up with not a lot of money, and to see what was possible when you take a risk and you invest in yourself and you invest in your future, it's a lesson that's stuck with me for my entire life.
Absolutely. And you know, you mentioned the element of luck, which is true with the timing, but as the saying goes, luck favors the prepared. And I don't know of any other 11-year-olds who are reading Peter Lynch books and and poring over Standard & Poor books either. So you were definitely prepared, and the timing was fortunate. So after Brown, you worked at AIG Insurance in China for a little while. How did you decide to then quit the stable job you had with AIG and take a chance as an entrepreneur?
It was an interesting story. So when I went to college, again, coming from a blue collar background, I didn't have a real paradigm for success. So the only things I knew you really could do was, one, become a lawyer like you, or two, become a doctor. Like, those are the two paths that I kind of knew. And I didn't want to go into law, so I thought medicine might be interesting. And so the reason why I chose Brown specifically is because at the time, and I don't know if this is true now, but at the time, Brown had the number one neuroscience department in the country. And I wanted to study neuroscience, really fascinated with brain science. So I studied neuroscience, became really fascinated with the brain, and along the way decided that I wanted to learn more about traditional Chinese medicine and the impact that traditional Chinese medicine has on the brain, things like acupuncture and herbs and all the sort of traditional treatments to so many neurological disorders. And so in order to do that, I had to learn Chinese. I had to learn to read and write Chinese. And so kind of went down this path. Well, along the way, something interesting happened where I became a lot more fascinated with China, Chinese culture, Chinese language, than I did with the brain. So I started moving away from this path toward becoming the next great neurosurgeon, which my parents were a little bit disappointed with, to becoming more interested in Chinese history and Chinese culture. And so after graduating from Brown, I wanted to work and live abroad. I wanted to experience that. So I moved to China and eventually arrived at, I was about 25 years old, at what was essentially my dream job. I was in charge of running expansion across China for AIG, at the time a Fortune 10 company.
Wow.
So I was running it, my mid-20s, I was managing a team of about 25 local staff. I could speak, read and write Chinese nearly fluently. So I was sort of the link between home office and the local Chinese team. And I'm running around China, opening up sales offices in city after city. And that was my job. It was like my dream job. And in my mid-20s, I sort of had this existential crisis where I looked at my life and I said, hang on a second, this is it? Like, I'd gotten my dream job. I was making pretty good money. I saw my boss, who was the president of China for AIG. I saw what his life was like. And I basically looked into my own future. I said, if I stay on the path that I'm on right now, that's what my life is going to be. And I just kind of had this moment where I said, I have so much more to give. There's so much more that I feel a duty to do something with. Like, I thought about, you know, my parents, I thought about my teachers, I thought about all the people in my life who had made sacrifices for me, who believed in me, who did something for me along the way to give me a leg up. And I just felt like I had this duty more than anything else to do something bigger with my life. So for a while, I've been thinking about, well, what did that look like? And I knew I wanted to do my own thing. I didn't know what that was. I knew I wanted to do my own thing and go off on my own. And so I've been talking with my wife about starting a business. She was doing her PhD at Hong Kong University, at HKU. I was based in Shanghai. She's in Hong Kong. So we had this kind of crazy bi-country marriage. We're like flying to see each other like every couple of weeks on an airplane. And we'd had these late night conversations, and I'd be kind of throwing out all these crazy harebrained ideas. But I was too afraid to take the leap. And then one day in 2008, in the middle of the world financial crisis, I went to work like any other day. I walked into my office, and the Wall Street Journal Asia edition read the headline, AIG to file for bankruptcy. And this was in the middle of the financial crisis with Bear Stearns and Lehman and AIG and all these companies that were going under. I called up my wife. She was in Hong Kong. She was just getting out of class. And I'm in Shanghai. I called her. I said, go to WSJ.com. Check out the headline. And she said, well, what does it mean? And I said, I don't know, but I think this is the sign I've been looking for. This is the kick in the pants that I've needed. And that day, I literally drafted up, printed up a resignation letter. I signed it. I rushed it over to my boss's office, walked over, knocked on his door and said, I need to talk and you're not going to be happy about this conversation. Turned in my resignation that day, gave a little over 2 weeks notice, sold everything that I owned on this planet except for what I could fit into a suitcase, moved in with my wife in student housing in Hong Kong, and got to work starting my first business. So that's the story. That's how it all happened. That's how it all began. And I wish I could say it was a straight line to success, but we're going to be talking about some of the failures along the way, including some big ones. But that's how it all began.
Yeah. Well, the path to success is rarely linear. So it totally makes sense that it began that way. Now, before we move on to the next stage here and talk about your journey as an entrepreneur, if someone in the audience here is listening to this conversation and they're currently in what they once upon a time thought was a dream job, but that's really not what they thought it would be. So they sort of find themselves in the situation that you found yourself in. They have an inch to do something else, either become an entrepreneur or to go teach yoga or whatever that might be. And they don't have this sign from the universe that came to you that says AIG to file for bankruptcy in the Wall Street Journal. What would you tell them? In other words, like if this person isn't fortunate to have this, like the company that you work for is about to go under or might go under, if we take that out of the equation, what advice would you give them to sort of do a reality check and to think through whether or not really the path that they're on is the right one and whether they should pursue something else?
In the last decade, I've spent a lot of my time working with other entrepreneurs. So I have an entire business, an entire team, an entire framework, an entire company where that's what I do all day, every day. And there's one thing that I see that happens, and it's an issue I see that happens in so many people, and it's this. People are afraid to give up good in order to go for great. There are a lot of people that I work with who have very good lives. Their lives are good, right? They've got good jobs. They've got a good house. They've got a good family. They've got a lot. Their life is good. It's not like they're living in a cardboard box on the side of the road with, you know, nothing to lose. It's that fear of loss that holds people back more than anything else. And then when I studied neuroscience at Brown, one of the things that I learned is that fear of loss is infinitely more powerful than the promise of gain. So we value things that we have far more than what we would pay to acquire those things from somebody else. It's just natural human nature. And I think one of the things that I've learned and the piece of advice that I'd give people is if you're in that situation right now, number one, recognize it for what it is. And number two, the key is to take steps to validate the thing that you're thinking of doing without necessarily risking it all. So I don't have one of these stories where I went, you know, through multiple bankruptcies and $200,000 in debt, credit cards to the max. That's not my story at all. My story is that I did quit my job, but I'm an incredibly risk-averse person. I applied to Brown when I was in high school, early action, because I wanted to know that I was going to get in. I was the first person in my high school to get into any college. I got in early. My first job after Brown, I was accepted to work at Goldman Sachs. I found out my junior year that I had a job waiting for me after my senior year. So I'm the type of person that wants to make sure everything is lined up. And what I've learned in the framework that I've used to build businesses in 23 different markets is you don't have to risk it all and go all in. You don't have to push all your chips in, burn the ships. That's a myth. But what you do need are these green light events that tell you that you are on the right track and you want to pursue the thing that you've thought about pursuing. And you don't have to quit your job to find the next green light. You don't have to give it all up. You can do it on nights. You can do it on weekends. You can take baby steps in that direction until you reach that point where you've validated the business or the idea that you're thinking of pursuing. And once you've validated, take that next big step.
The issue of validation, it's incredible how rare it is. People often take the leap without thinking twice about it. And I see this a lot in my own students as a law professor. A good portion of them come to law school without really knowing what it's like to practice law. Now, without really knowing, like, you know, having talked to a lawyer about what the day-to-day practice of law is like. And some of them end up being happy as lawyers, but some of them don't because going into it, they didn't really do their research. And so being able to validate what you're doing without quitting your job and putting, you know, proverbially all of your eggs in one basket is super, super important. Let's move on to the second stage of your life. So you leave your job at AIG and then you go to Hong Kong to start your own business. What happens from there?
You got to remember, my wife's pursuing a PhD and she's been listening to many late night conversations about all my harebrained ideas to start a business. We're having one of these conversations over dinner and I'm saying, oh, we could do, you know, let's open up a cupcake shop. Cupcakes are just getting hot. Like, we can set up a cupcake shop in Hong Kong, or we can start a business teaching Mandarin. You know, everyone wants to learn Chinese. Like, we can start a business teaching Mandarin. So all these crazy ideas, all import export company. At one point I was like, let's open up a McDonald's franchise. Like, I mean, we're like all over the map, like so many bad ideas. And so at one time we're having this dinner, she's like, hang on, I have an idea. I want to show you this thing. She said, take a look at this website. It was a brand new website at the time. She said, take a look at this website. It's like eBay for handmade goods, Etsy.com. Now, Etsy today is a multi-billion dollar company, but it was a brand new startup when she introduced it to me. And she said, take a look. There's this jewelry that's selling like crazy on Etsy.com, and it's called Scrabble Tile Jewelry. Basically what it is you take Scrabble tiles, you combine them with origami paper, put a resin over it, you make it into this jewelry that you can make into brooches and necklaces and cufflinks and everything like that. And she said, here we are in China. We have access to all the origami paper in the world. We have access just across the border in southern China to inexpensive labor. We could set up a little factory in southern China, manufacture this jewelry and import it into the United States. What do you think? And I said, honey, that's a terrible idea. We're not going to do this. And so we shut the book on the idea. Fast forward a few weeks later, we're having yet another one of these conversations about what type of business should we start. And she says, I want to bring you back to the Scrabble tile thing. And I said, honey, I thought we closed the book on that. I thought that was, you know, we said it was a bad idea. She said, no, time out. Take a look at this woman's shop. I remember she turned the computer to me and she showed me this woman's shop on Etsy. And she said, look at this woman. She's not selling the jewelry. Instead, she's teaching people how to make the jewelry. She's selling this little tutorial on Etsy. And take a look. Now, the cool thing about Etsy is that you can see a person's sales history. So you can see exactly how much money they're making in their business. And so she said, look at this. She's selling this little tutorial for like $30. And she's selling like 30 to 35 copies a day. And we went back and we looked at yesterday's sales and the day before that, the week before that, the week before that, the month back. We found out that this woman was making $10,000 a month teaching people how to make Scrabble tile jewelry. And so my wife said, listen, I bought her tutorial. It's actually not very good. She said, I think I can learn how to make the jewelry and we can build a better product. And that's exactly what we did. So my wife learned how to make this jewelry. We shot video, we did a printed tutorial, and we started selling it on Etsy. First month, we sold a couple $100 worth of tutorials. Next month, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $8,000 a month. I said, oh my gosh, honey, we're going to get rich. Like, we're going to get rich selling Scrabble tile jewelry tutorials. This is crazy. And then it was on literally the next month. I'm not joking. Literally the next month, our sales went down to almost nothing. And we had this moment where we kind of looked at each other and said, oh crap, what do we do now? And it turns out the whole Scrabble tile jewelry thing was just a fad. It was just a total fad. It was like Beanie Babies or Pogs or fidget spinners or any of these things that just goes huge for like a minute and then just drops off the face of the earth. And at this point, you know, we're in Hong Kong. My wife's not making any salary doing her PhD. We're in the most expensive city in the world. We've burned through most of our savings. And we have this moment where we say, well, what do we do now? And we made the decision that my wife finished her program. She got a job in the United States in Texas, and her academic background is in the history of art and history as a museum curator at the Brownsville, Texas Historical Association, paying $36,000 a year. So we didn't have the money to bring our possessions home with us to America. So we had to donate everything that we owned except for a suitcase each, moved into a 500 square foot apartment in Brownsville, Texas, less than a mile away from the Mexican border in the poorest zip code in the contiguous United States. We had bars on the windows. We had a mattress on the floor. We had two lawn chairs as our furniture, one used car that I would drive my wife in to and from work every single day. And I got to work. And I learned the first lesson, a lesson that I share in my most recent book, Choose, which is all about making the single most important decision before you start anything, before you start your business. And I learned the importance of not going into a fad market.
Right.
And so the next business that we started, I said, well, if that's a fad market, I'm going to go into something that's been around forever, that has no risk of being a fad. What is the oldest, longest lasting hobby in America? And I don't know if you know the answer to this. I didn't know the answer to this, so I was like curious to know. And for the last 100 years, you know what the number one hobby has been in America? It's been number one or number two almost every year for the last 100 years. Any guesses on what it is?
No idea. Hobby? Huh. No, nothing comes to mind. What is it?
Gardening.
Gardening. Okay.
So number one and number two every single year has been either reading or gardening. And something like over 100 million Americans, you know, consider gardening to be a hobby of theirs. And obviously it's taken different shapes and forms over the past few decades, but it's been something that's been around forever. So I started doing research looking at what are the different niches, the different markets within the gardening market. And there was one that stood out, and it was the orchid market. And the reason why it stood out is when we lived in China, when we were living in Shanghai, my wife hadn't yet started her PhD program. We were both living in Shanghai. I kind of tricked my wife and I showed her like photos of what China looks like, you know, Guilin, picturesque, you know, green, beautiful mountains in the background. And we moved to China and it was like smog city. And so she said, all right, well, if we're going to stay here, we need to make our apartment more green. I've always wanted to grow orchids. Let's buy a bunch of orchids. So I bought a bunch of orchids. We filled the apartment with them. And like literally a week later, they all died. And so I thought, well, if we had trouble keeping our orchids alive, maybe there are other people who had the same challenges. So we started doing research into the orchid market. And long story short, took that business using the process that I outlined in my first book, Ask, to understand the market at a deep emotional level. Took that business from nothing to $25,000 a month in about a year and a half. At that point, my wife quit her job, started working with me in the business. We moved to Austin, Texas, which is where we've been ever since. Took the business to about $500,000 a year. And 10 years later, that business to this day still pays for our entire living expenses. And I share that in an exercise in contrasts to compare the orchid market with the Scrabble tile market and the allure that I think some of these fads draw people to. More recently, there's one that I think will be familiar to you when I bring it up. Of course, I mentioned fidget spinners already, but what was the topic? And maybe it didn't hit you in your circles in the same way that it hit me in my circles. About a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, that you could not go online on social media without someone talking about like this huge boon. Do you remember what I'm talking about? It was about a year and a half, 2 years ago. When I say it, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about.
There are actually a couple of things that come to mind when you talk about imitation and fads that existed 2 years ago that no longer exist.
The big one I'm thinking about is Bitcoin. You could not turn a corner without somebody talking about Bitcoin this and, oh my gosh, Bitcoin is a future. And oh my gosh, like I'm quitting my job and I'm going to start a Bitcoin podcast, or I'm starting a Bitcoin exchange, or a Bitcoin this, Bitcoin that. At the end of 2000, I believe it was 17. I can't remember if it was 18 or 17. So I may have the year wrong, but it was in December. Bitcoin reached an all-time high. And then literally within days, the market completely crashed.
Right.
And if you look on Google Trends, which is a free tool, it's one of my favorite tools because it's a great tool to look at the size of markets, the competitiveness of markets. Google makes all this information available for free. You can look at Bitcoin as a search term. And if you look at the last 5 years, you'll see how it goes up, 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 and then falls off a cliff, and it falls perfectly in line with the Bitcoin price crash that we're talking about. And it underscores the important point. It's what I call in my most recent book, Choose, one of the five market must-haves. Five things that you absolutely want to make sure your market has. And one of those things is to be in an evergreen market. It's what I call a metronome market, a market that just ticks along every single year. Markets like leadership skills, markets like build confidence, markets like beekeeping, markets like orchid care, markets that have been around 10 years ago and they're going to be around 100 years from now. Not markets that come and go, not markets that the media is constantly talking about and writing about. Those are the markets that attract a lot of competition, and they grow very quickly, but they die very quickly as well. So you want to look for these metronome markets that are going to sustain you for decades into the future.
That's such great advice. So invest in things that don't change, in a sense, right? Because chasing trends, as you said, can work in the short term. And with your Scrabble jewelry business, it did, right? You hit $10,000 a month in sales, but then it fizzled out from there. It ends up being a recipe for long-term disaster. And over time, imitation makes the original obsolete. The same path, right, that leads to glory for one person can cause catastrophe for the other. But the instinct to imitate is, I think, a natural one, right? Like, that's how you learn everything. When you're growing up, you look to how other people are walking, how other people are tying their shoes. All learning in our younger years happens through emulation. And so when you're first starting a business, I think it's probably natural to look to what other people are doing around you and, you know, what's working and what's not working, and then attempt to copy them. But then if what you're copying ends up being just a fad, be it Scrabble jewelry or Bitcoin or, I don't know, the Fast and Furious series, like they've made 17 of those movies, it can work in the short term, but it ends up being a really poor investment in the long term.
Exactly. It's a game. It's very difficult to time things the right way. And you can see it now. If you look at some of the diet trends that were hot a few years ago, people jump into them. Right now, the hot thing at the recording of this interview is keto.
Right.
It's keto everything. It's a ketogenic diet. Well, I can guarantee you at some point in the future, I don't know if it's going to be a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, keto is not going to be the hot thing anymore. There's going to be something that replaces it.
Right.
Primal replaced paleo. Paleo was the big thing. Now it's primal, right? So you can see all this movement. You're looking for markets. This is the key. This is a great tactic to take away from this interview is go to Google Trends and you're looking for markets when you type in keywords that are stable. They are stable year after year after year. Markets that are trending markets that have a breakout a path, just like when you're plotting stock charts, plotting keyword trends, markets that have a breakout period oftentimes have a steep decline and crash thereafter. And it's difficult to catch it. You don't know if you're at the beginning of an upward trend or if you're at the very end of an impending crash.
And I think the same applies to social media platforms, for example. It breaks my heart to see someone spend all of their time building their following on Instagram and like not building an email list, not investing in other sources of growth, just assuming that Instagram is going to be around and popular for, well, the indefinite future. But then, you know, the next thing you know, they change their algorithm and then you had access to all of these people and you don't have access to them anymore. It makes a lot of sense to try to determine whether or not what you're chasing is a trend and also to hedge your bets. So not, you know, invest all of your time on Instagram and build an email list as well, because email has been around for a really long time and Instagram might fizzle out, even though it probably, to someone who's listening to this in 2019, it sounds like, you know, really, really difficult for a platform like Instagram to not be around 5 years, 10 years from now. But you never know. I mean, look at MySpace, look at Friendster. So it's really important to hedge your bets and invest in other platforms as well.
You mean my MySpace account isn't worth anything anymore? I was investing in that still.
So you've got this great profitable business on Orchid Gardens. And then fast forward to 2012 and you ended up in the ICU. What happened?
I thought the orchid thing was a fluke. I did. You know, I had the experience from the Scrabble tile thing behind me, and I thought this I was going to have the same thing happen again. So I diversified into another market. I went into a market that was really designed to make my parents happy, because I wanted to show them that I was using my neuroscience background from Brown in my career. So I went into the memory improvement market. I decided to start teaching people how to improve their memory using mnemonics and memory techniques. And so we built a brand called Rocket Memory. It still exists today, and took that business to about $500,000 a year. And I kind of started developing this formula. And I proceeded by going into 23 different niche markets, everything from orchid care, memory improvement, to tennis training, golf training, satellite television, alkaline health, high-end water filtration systems, business funding, all these different markets. And so if it sounds like I was putting the pedal to the metal, I was. And in 2012, when I turned 30 years old, I was blessed with the greatest gift of my life. My first son was born, you know, as a new dad. And a CEO running a fast-growing company, I wasn't getting a whole lot of sleep. I started losing a lot of weight. Now, at the recording of this interview, obviously you can't see me. I'm about 185, 190 pounds, pretty good shape, about maybe 12% body fat right now, pretty good shape. After my son was born, within 6 months, I had dropped down to 132 pounds. I just chalked it up to the fact that I was working hard, not getting a lot of sleep, you know, new dad, sleepless nights, you know, baby who's not sleeping through the night, trying to run a business, trying to run multiple businesses, and I wasn't taking great care of myself. And I was about to head out to a business trip, and before I did, my wife said, "All right, you're dad now, you need to apply for life insurance." And so I applied for life insurance, went on the trip, came back, had a letter waiting for me on my desk, opened up the letter, and the letter was from the life insurance company, and it said, "Application denied." Now, if you've ever applied for life insurance before, you probably know that the only way you are denied coverage is for something like you are terminally ill with cancer. You are on dialysis. You can be a smoker, you can be a drinker, you can be obese, and you can get life insurance coverage. To be denied, there's got to be something wrong. So I get this letter, I pick up the phone, I call up the life insurance agent, and I said, there's been a mistake. I got somebody else's letter in the mail. Not mine. There's a mistake. And the life insurance agent said, it's not a mistake. And I have your lab results from the exam with me. And I think you may want to sit down. And he proceeded to read me a bunch of lab numbers. And I wrote them all down. And he said, he ended the phone call by saying, "Listen, I'm not a doctor, but I think you might want to go see one." And I hung up the phone. And then I made the biggest mistake of my life. I went to Google to see what the numbers meant. And the numbers came back with kidney failure, renal system shutdown, and pancreatic cancer. 30 years old, 6 month old baby, and I'm freaking the hell out. And that night my wife said, "Hey, I saw we got the letter from the life insurance company in the mail. Are we all good? All set?" I said, "Honey, I think we need to talk." Now at this point, I still think it's a mistake. I think my lab results must have gotten crossed with somebody else's. I say, "There's no way that this is me." So I tell her the lab results, what they meant. She breaks down. She calls the Ask a Nurse hotline. We call for a doctor's appointment the next day, go to see a doctor. And I'm one of these guys that, you know, I'd lived in China. I hadn't seen a doctor for a checkup in years. We go to the doctor's next day and we tell him the situation. He says, "Well, let's order some labs. We'll order them stat, hang out in the waiting room for a bit, and I'll come get you when the lab results are ready." I remember it like it was yesterday. He walked out into the waiting room. He grabs me by the shoulders and he says, "Mr. Levesque, you should be in a coma right now. We have to rush you to the emergency room." And so they rush me to the emergency room. I get there and I find out that my body had slipped into a state known as DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis. And it turns out at 30 years old, I was an undiagnosed juvenile diabetic and my organs were shutting down. And the reason why I lost all that weight is my body lost the ability to metabolize food and I was just eating away muscle tissue. I had to be put in ICU, intensive care, for 10 days. Speaking of the cancer patient, dialysis patient, I had a dialysis patient on one side of me, a cancer patient in the room next door. Here I am, 30 years old, and I really had to come to terms with what I was going to do with my life if I got out of there. And as I tell people, nothing gives you more clarity of purpose than coming to terms with your own mortality. And I said to myself, I said, if I get out of this, it was kind of like that wake-up call. Once again, and I said, if I come out of this experience alive, number one, I've got to make some changes in my life. I'm going to get in the best shape of my life. I'm going to use this for a force of good. And number two, it was just this huge wake-up call that none of us are promised tomorrow. And I said, if I'm going to do something great in this world, it's not someday maybe, it's now. Because if I don't do it now, who knows how long I've got. And I came out of the hospital and decided to reveal the methodology I used to build businesses in these 23 different markets. That was the subject of my first book, Ask, went on to become a number one national best-selling book. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It's Inc. magazine rated it the number one marketing book of the year. Entrepreneur rated it their number two marketing book of the year. You know, it just went off in this direction I never expected it to go. It's what inspired me to write my most recent book, Choose, which is the prequel to Ask. Ask was how we entered 23 different markets profitably. Choose was how we chose those markets in the first place. And it's really the book designed for anybody who's thinking about starting a business, who wants to do their own thing, who wants to do their own boss, but doesn't really know where to begin. And all that happened because of, I decided to reveal my secret family recipe. Right. I decided to reveal all my markets. Right. Like, you know, who would do that? Like, who would reveal like all of the little secret businesses that I've built and all my keywords and everything that I've done? And I did it because I realized that I'd impacted a small number of people in a small way, but I wanted to do something on a much bigger scale. And so, you know, that's why I decided to write the book. And that's why we're having this conversation right now, because I've seen what this has been able to do for a blue collar kid who grew up in New Hampshire, first in his family go to college, to build multiple multi-million dollar businesses, land on the Inc. 500 fastest growing companies in America. I've seen what it's done for me, how it's transformed my life, my kids' lives, future generations in my family. I want to give that gift back, you know, for all the people who have done so much for me in my life. This is sort of my way to make the world a slightly better place.
So what prompted you to write the prequel? Because you had this, Ask was a, as you said, a mega successful number one national best-selling book. It did really, really well. Why a second book? What prompted you to write this one?
Well, you know, when I wrote my first book, I never intended on writing a second book. I said, I'm pouring it all in. I'm just putting it all in this, and I just want to give it all away. I just want to, you know, tell my story and share the methodology that's transformed my life. And I put it all in there. But what I didn't realize, when you write a book like that, as you probably know from your podcast and your book and the work that you've done, people write to you. And, you know, I've gotten handwritten letters. I've gotten packages in the mail. I've gotten countless emails and Facebook messages from people who say, your book changed my life. But you also get letters and very friendly Amazon reviews and all sorts of feedback from people who say, I read your book and it didn't work for me. It didn't work. And when you get messages like that, it's a little bit like a sucker punch in the gut. You're kind of thinking to yourself, where did I go wrong? Like, what did I miss? You start second guessing yourself. And so it kind of led me down this rabbit hole. And what I found is that all roads kept pointing back to the same place. And that's this: the people who were struggling, the people who were failing, were starting by making the single biggest mistake in their business. They were starting by choosing bad markets. And there's this metaphor that I use in Choose that I think is really helpful to understand this. It's sort of like this: when you start a business or start anything, it's sort of like tossing your raft in a river. You toss your raft in a river with the expectation that the river is going to take you to your destination, where you want to go. And in business, you're building a business that's going to take you to where you want to go in life. But the problem is this: I found that, you know, despite having the best possible raft, in some cases, despite hiring the most capable crew, in some cases, despite rowing 18 hours a day, it doesn't matter how hard you work, how good your crew is, how good your boat is. If you put your raft in a river that doesn't have any water in it, or you put your raft in a river facing the wrong direction, you're never going to get to where you want to go. And that's what I found people were doing over and over and over again. They were tossing their raft in rivers that no matter how hard they worked, how good their crew was, how good their equipment was, they were never going to get to their destination. And I realized the mistake that I made in Ask is that I assumed that people were choosing good markets. What I didn't teach in Ask was how I chose and why I chose the 23 markets that I decided to pursue. The methodology behind that, out of the million possibilities, why those specific opportunities? And so what I started looking at, I was really inspired by the work of Jim Collins, if you're familiar with Jim Collins.
Sure, yeah. From Good to Great.
Yeah, Good to Great, Great by Choice, Built to Last. I'm a huge fan of his work. And for anyone not familiar, Jim Collins' work is built around this idea that there are factors that separate companies that have stood the test of time and companies that have maybe succeeded for a season and have either disappeared or gone by the wayside. And I became really obsessed, which led me down really this three-year research project to understand what are the factors that actually make a good market. Like, it's easy for you and me to say, well, go into a good market, right? Like, that's easy for us to say that soundbite, but what does that mean exactly? And so I started researching all of the markets that we went into and looked at, well, some of our businesses were more successful than others. What was it that separated that? I started doing the same thing with my students, with our clients. And what I ended up finding is that there are seven key factors that separate our most successful home run businesses from everything else. And in Choose, I reveal exactly what those factors are and the tests that you can perform basically for free to identify if your business idea, your market, the thing that you're thinking about starting, if it passes these seven tests, if it's a green light, or if it's a yellow light, meaning proceed with caution, or if it's a red light, in which case you want to pivot or move in a new direction.
Excellent. Well, Ryan, we've come to the end of our time here. Thank you so much for joining us. This is so much fun. If people want to learn more about you, if they want to check out Choose, where should they find you online?
Well, listen, Ozan, I wanted to do something super special for you and for your audience. So here's what we've done. I've arranged with my team to set aside a small number of hardcover copies of the book that I'm going to give away for free. All I ask is that you pay a few dollars shipping and handling, and I'll ship it to you anywhere in the world. And when you do that, I'm going to hook you up with a whole bunch of cool bonuses, including the audiobook. So if you're the type of person who likes to listen, I'm going to give you the audiobook for free. One of the biggest questions I get from people is, what are examples of green light markets that pass each of these seven tests? Well, I'm going to give you 25 of the most lucrative markets that I would be going into right now. So I've gone into 23. These are the next ones that I'd be going into. I'm giving you that, my personal list, and a whole bunch of other cool bonuses. When you go to the link, choosethebook.com/famousfailures. And again, it's a free hardcover copy of the book. Just pay a few dollars shipping and handling. I'll ship it to you anywhere in the world, and I'll hook you up with over $200 in free bonuses.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ryan, for that. And we'll include that link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining us, Ryan.
Thanks so much, my friend, and have a safe trip. I know you've got an exciting trip, and I'm honored to be your final guest before you've got your big adventure coming up, my friend.
Thank you. I'm so glad we were able to squeeze you in. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.